The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League, the greatest league in the world where anyone can beat anyone. Norwich City, with eight players out, beat Manchester City at Carrow Road. What does this mean for the league? Have City left Laporte open for Liverpool to win it? Elsewhere, Arsenal are even worse than City at playing it out from the back. Lampard wins away at Wolves while Spurs trample over Crystal Palace. In Europe, a late winner from Neymar is not enough to silence the haters, while a 16-year-old scores for Barcelona for the second game on the bounce. We'll round up the Football League, FitBar and the WSL, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, John Bruin, hello.
Hello, Max.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
How are you?
Very well.
Excellent. Quite a dismissive very well. Barry, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
And chief sports reporter, Sean Ingle, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
What exclusives have you got for us with your chief sports reporting-ness?
I am working on a couple, but non-football related at the moment.
Okay, what sport are they?
I prefer not to say it. People might be listening.
Oh, really?
The Wolves have ears.
Okay. Is it a dog-eat-dog world at that level of sports reporting?
It is a little bit.
Okay.
The Wolves have ears, he says, talking into a live microphone in a recording studio.
Many of our listeners have ears as well, don't they? Right, let's start then at Carrow Road, shall we? Norwich City 3, Manchester City 2. I mean, they had three shots on target and scored three goals, John, but feel that they deserved this victory.
Yes, because they were in the game the whole time, because they forced Manchester City into making the mistakes that they made. Daniel Farke, the Stephen Hendry lookalike.
Everyone was thinking, actually, yes, I can see. I mean, because Hendry never had that hair. You have to imagine if Hendry had grown his hair.
Yeah, and join a biker gang or something like that.
Sean, you don't just have to put your hand up. You can talk whenever you like.
Surely it's kind of Roger Federer's slightly older and chubbier brother, isn't it?
Cousin, yeah. Anyway.
Somewhere between Hendry and Depardieu, isn't it?
Anyway, well, Daniel Farke, on the quiet, is a pretty decent tactician. I think many teams over
Don't tell anyone, John, the Wolves have ears.
Yes, yes. People have been looking for the secret of getting at Manchester City. Now, it does turn out that if they have two ropey central defenders who cost a combined price of somewhere about £85 million, you can get at them. Pep Guardiola talks after the game about how there is a collective solution to the problem, but the problem is an individual problem in the fact that they didn't sign another central defender. Otamendi is almost like he's a player you look at and you think he's quite lucky to be playing for a team as good as Manchester City. Manchester City possibly are the best team in Europe, and yet they've got Nicolas Otamendi in defence. And yet they could have signed Harry Maguire. They chose not to. They decided that they didn't want to pay the price for him. And this was a game where that came unstuck. And the one thing that did make me laugh, actually, was Pep Guardiola, who says he doesn't read anything that anyone writes about him, made reference to the fact that people have called him Fraudiola in the past.
But he didn't read it.
He didn't read it.
No. Paul McInnes writing in the paper today, actually saying, look, the best centre-back combination for City in the past 18 months is Aymeric Laporte and Vincent Kompany. 11 games and a 91% win ratio. Jason says, has City's title defence gone pear-shaped over losing one defender? A $1 billion team with some $200 million worth of talent on the bench yet can't get past an injury-hit newly promoted side? Or is it a bump in the road?
Only time will tell, I suppose, but it's a bump that's come very early in the road, you know, very quickly after Aymeric Laporte was ruled out. So you'd have to say the omens aren't great. John Stones' form has gone off a cliff recently. When you watch him play with Otamendi, you always feel that one or both of them is capable of a rick. And so it came to pass against a superbly well-drilled Norwich City side.
But we can talk about how Otamendi might be not good enough to play in that team. Yet that third goal, that's not... You know, if my Saturday team did that,
yeah,
we'd be furious, right? And I know Arsenal did it as well. We'll talk about playing out from the back. But that is just... It's just so bad. It's beyond believable, right?
Absolutely. As you say, it was sub-Sunday league football. I mean, I'd still put it a bit into context. City have still scored more goals than anyone else. They still had more shots than anyone else. And actually, crucially, they've still had less shots conceded than anyone else. So even though we know their centre-half pairing are ropey, the fact they have so much possession means that if they can cut out these horrible individual errors, you've got to think they're still favourites for the Premier League.
And I think the fact that their central defence does look so ropey under pressure, probably the reason for that is they're not used to being under pressure. So when they do come under pressure, there's a very good chance they may buckle.
But
the fact that they're rarely under pressure is a positive.
Sure, sure. But you know, Liverpool only lost one game last season. It's unlikely that you imagine both of those sides will lose more than one game, maybe two. But a defeat is so significant at the top of the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, I think since, I suppose, Jose Mourinho arrived in English football 15 years ago, that margin for error has decreased. Alex Ferguson used to say, lose six games a season, you can cope with that. Now it's essentially one or two games a season, to the point where drawing a game is a pretty bad state of affairs. And I don't know, Manchester City, perhaps they're paying for, I mean, you said they've lost one player. They've actually lost two, of course. Kompany went.
Yeah, of course.
And I saw someone say that Kompany had retired and having to change back that, because he hasn't retired. He's going to be player manager, except he's not the manager and he doesn't play. So anyway, but let's turn it around and pay tribute to Norwich. Timo Pukki, Player of the Month on Friday. He was awarded that. Now, you know they have a curse of the Manager of the Month. Do you have a curse for Player of the Month?
Don't know. Don't think so.
He certainly didn't look like he'd got any curse. He played
magnificently. Well, all four league managers of the month, three of them lost over the weekend.
Okay.
Apart from Jurgen Klopp.
He did play well. And this guy, Todd Cantwell, who I confess didn't know anything about until this season started, looks like a tremendous player. And Buendia as well got a lot of praise on Match of the Day. And those three were brilliant.
One of them's an academy product, Cantwell, and the other two were bought for a song. One was a free transfer. Pukki and Buendia cost a couple of million.
Yeah, from Getafe, yeah. I mean, Norwich come up. I mean, pre-season, we always talk about transfer budgets and what teams spend. Norwich spent next to nothing coming up. And they've turned up looking, if not ready-made for the Premier League, looking capable of surviving. Even in that first game against Liverpool, where they conceded four goals pretty readily, they created a lot of chances. And you looked at them and thought, they've got a chance of staying up. And you know, this may well be the shock result of the season, so for the rest of the season. But that was a brilliant performance and a great day for them.
They were 25-1 in your local high street bookie. So it was it probably would
which
be
I think is the longest ever odds for a Premier League match.
Not a match. I remember I think Man United hosted Blackburn around Christmas time a few years ago. Uh-oh. You could have got Blackburn at slightly big odds.
Okay.
And listeners are now invited to circle Shawnee Mentions betting odds in their Football Weekly bingo.
The Norwich City Twitter feed before the game: Tim Close is out for 9 months, Zimmerman out until January, Grant Hanley's not ready, Tom Tribal's damaged his ligaments, Patrick Roberts is ineligible, Morris Leitner's out with his calf, Vrancic has a calf strain, Aarons is out, Godfrey's a doubt, Tim Krul is a minor doubt. Krul did play, but missing that many players, I just wonder. And you don't think teams at this level should be complacent, but you wonder if Manchester City, you know, they rested De Bruyne. I know he played twice in midweek, but you just wonder if that comes into play when they think, they're missing half their squad. We should probably win this. Or is that just not good enough, even if it's true?
Even if it's true, you know, they went 1-0. They didn't do an Arsenal on it. You know, they weren't 2-0 ahead and then completely capitulated. They went a goal behind to it. You know, it was pretty bad goal to concede, near post header from a corner.
It's a goal that they have conceded quite a lot. It's a Manchester City weakness is the set pieces, the defending of them.
Yeah, Moura's goal for Spurs was similar, wasn't it, actually?
So if going 2-0 down isn't going to jolt them out of complacency, I'm not sure what exactly would.
There was a lovely moment at the end when, after Rodri scored, when Tim Krul tried to jump on the ball. I mean, literally got up. You know when keepers do that in the warm-up? They save one and get up quickly and save another ball. He basically jumped on that ball. I'm a big fan of defending teams who've conceded a goal but still have the lead, trying to just not let the opposition have the ball. But the last 10 minutes was just watching the Norwich fan, the agony of the Norwich fans, just praying that they'd hold on. You know, some of them just couldn't watch. It was superb, wasn't it? Thank you to producer Jonathan, who has, just for the benefit of us, put Stephen Hendry's face with Daniel Farke's hair. It's actually quite good. It does look quite a lot like... If you could get Hendry, Farke and Depardieu together as a sort of three musketeers.
The evolution of man.
Was Depardieu ever a musketeer? He must have been.
I think
Portos,
he was.
Mustn't he?
Yes.
In the Musketeers. Orgasmic Crisis, what sort of team building bonding event would Barry suggest to mend the relationship between John Stones and Nicolas Otamendi?
I can't really think of any relationship breakdown that, you know, between mates, not exact, you know, partners, that can't be fixed or indeed further damaged by a very long drinking session.
Okay. You surprise all of us, Barry, with that suggestion. City go to Shakhtar on Wednesday. Also in that group, Dinamo Zagreb versus Atalanta. Producer Jonathan points out that Depardieu was once in a film called La Femme Musketeer, in which D'Artagnan teaches his daughter the way of the sword. Gerard played Cardinal Mazarin. I'm sure he played Portos in the Three Musketeers, but look, maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe that's the role that he's been waiting for all his life.
Teaching people the way of the sword.
God.
Well, I was thinking more Porthos, but you make a good point, Barry.
Right, all that means, well, none of that particularly means, but something means that Liverpool are 5 points clear at the top. It's theirs to lose. You know, they should stop paying out, shouldn't they, on Liverpool. Barry and I were disagreeing about who was the best of the three this week. I said Mane, Barry said Firmino. Who, you know, because they're the three best players in the world, right? But one of them is the best at any given day. John, who are you giving it to at the moment?
Well, Mane is the man in possession at the moment, but Firmino, this is a guy that's flown halfway across the world, presumably was, you know, wiping the sleep out of his eyes when he ran on the field and yet produced some moments of sublime brilliance. You mentioned that lead, actually. I think I read that the 5-point lead at this stage of the season is the biggest lead anyone's ever held at this point of a Premier League season. So
when Liverpool don't win the title now,
they've blown it from this point, yeah.
That flick from Firmino for Salah's goal is just, it's heaven, isn't it? Isn't that why we love football? That moment?
He was sublime, and I mean, I had some Liverpool fans were claiming he was the best ever Brazilian in the Premier League, I was reading about, which...
Yeah, we have a question from Elliot going, after his ridiculous display, can we now say Firmino is the finest Brazilian to have ever played in the Premier League? Fernandinho, Gilberto Silva, Juninho, I thought of three. There's not...
Coutinho as well.
Coutinho, yes, but... Gabriel Jesus is quite good. David Luiz and Willian have won titles, but...
Edison
is good.
Alex, there's been a few decent-ish defenders. I suppose of those players you mentioned, the one who achieved the most for the longest is probably Gilberto.
But not as fun as Juninho, right?
No, Juninho was, I suppose, the first of his kind. All of us are old enough to remember Mirandinha, but that was a pre-Premier League era. I can't really argue against Firmino being probably the best.
And actually, there's a great photo of after Firmino's flicked it to Salah from the back. Van Dijk is celebrating. I'm not sure if Salah's even taken his first touch, let alone scored. He's just celebrating already. And the football they're playing, Barry, is just sensational, isn't it?
On their day, and their day tends to be most days, they're pretty unstoppable, that front three. And you try and shackle one and the other two run riot, and it's just nigh on impossible to defend against.
So why is it do we keep saying City are the favourites? You know, before the games, I sort of think, well, I don't give an opposition a chance against City, and I do against Liverpool, even though, you know, last year Liverpool only lost once, and I know City won the league, they lost four times, didn't they? Is it just my problem, or do we all have a sort of...
Well, I think, I mean, they have won the last two titles. You know, 2 years ago they had over 100 points. Last year they, what was it, 97, 98?
Yeah.
So you're arguing...
I'm allowed to think they're good.
You're allowed to think... I mean, what I think is quite interesting is those of us who grew up in the 80s, 70s and 80s, it got tiresome, Liverpool winning everything. And I think there was a lot of people out there that, you know, sort of despised Liverpool for winning so much. I wonder if those same people now are kind of have made their peace with that and actually like to see them, you know, win a title for the first time since 1990.
I think one of the things is that in recent years we've learned, specifically under the last two seasons under Guardiola, is that they can be unbeatable. But we're still going historically back to the point that Liverpool and title races in the Premier League era have, they've had a few disasters, some catastrophes on the way. It's Gerrard, Gerrard's slip, and you know Rafa's going so close 10 years ago or so. But I do agree with you, Max. Actually, look through those two teams and compare them. Edison and Alisson, goalkeepers, not much in it. Defensively, well, Liverpool have Van Dijk at the time of player that Pep Guardiola would kill to have in his team. Midfield-wise, possibly you say Manchester City's is slightly better. And attack-wise, at the moment, despite the fact City have got Aguero and Raheem Sterling, Liverpool's attack is better.
But the obvious point is City have like
two for one. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Their second team would finish what? Fifth in the league, sixth in the league, something like that. You'd fancy them over Arsenal, wouldn't you? Their second team at the moment to finish high.
Well, if Arsenal keep playing out from the back. Fun bit of VAR, Barry. Jamal Lascelles throwing Joel Matip to the floor, but not clear and obvious.
It seems to have been clear and obvious to everyone, apart from the people whose job it is to decide that it's clear and obvious. In the BT Sport studio, or in the cupboard outside the BT Sport studio in which referees are kept, Mr. Walton, seemed to think that it wasn't clear and obvious, which I find quite extraordinary, because it was. But this isn't the first time Jamal Lascelles has got away with defying the VAR odds.
We should say well done, Jethro Willems, for giving Liverpool a scare, at least, and what a lovely strike it was.
Yes, although the feint and flick that he did was delivered at glacial speed that I was a little surprised that Trent Alexander-Arnold got. It was like, remember Mark Walters had that one trick.
Mm.
He was quite good at it.
Yeah.
Or the Phil Neville step over, which was, you know, they're so delivered so slowly.
And somebody put the Phil Neville step over to, I think, Vanessa Carlton's 1,000 Miles. And it's a wonderful, you know, the little piano. And it's just a great video. Anyway, John.
But yeah, and I think Trent was fooled by the fact that it was done so slowly. But great finish.
Here are Liverpool's upcoming Premier League fixtures. Stop me when you think they'll first drop points. Chelsea away.
Stop.
Really? Okay. You're on your own, John. Sheffield United away?
No.
Leicester at home?
No.
Manchester United away?
I think they'll win that.
Spurs at home?
They normally win that.
Villa away?
Should win that.
Man City at home?
That one.
Okay. That's lucky because I didn't have any more of their picks. I didn't want to do the whole season. So you think Chelsea will take something off them? Are you going based on what happened on at the weekend and Chelsea played well?
I think it's possible.
Okay. Great stat from Richard Jolly here. James Milner has now been a Premier League footballer for exactly half his life. It is 6,154 days since his Premier League debut, and that came 6,154 days after his birth. You don't know what you can do with that stat?
I worry about Richard Jolly. He comes up with these stats, and I worry about...
He's a dear friend of mine. You don't need to worry about him. He's okay. Yeah.
Does he just sit at home?
He has...
I know Richard Jolly not particularly well, but his stats are just amazing.
Yeah, he is a mind that is just, you know, he cannot be conquered. It's incredible.
Because he must have sat there and thought, oh, this must be happening soon. He's been sitting on this one.
Yeah, yeah.
And hope no one broke the embargo.
Well, all I can say is about Richard is there's a lot of pale imitators out there that try and pull off that type of thing. Him and Duncan Alexander are the top men in that game.
They are the Liverpool and Manchester City. Liverpool go to Napoli on Tuesday in the Champions League, also in that group, RB Salzburg versus Genk. Right, Watford 2, Arsenal 2. Watford had 31 shots in this game, the most they've ever had in a Premier League game, the most shots Arsenal have ever faced in a Premier League game. 23 of those shots came in the second half. Granit Xhaka said we were scared in the second half, also said it was quite a hot day. And it was a great comeback from Watford. But Arsenal were barely there in the first half before Aubameyang scored. And then in the second half, they just weren't there at all. It was bizarre, wasn't it?
What was quite interesting, I was looking through Twitter after the game and Wenger was trending. and quite a lot of the same people, I think, who had wanted Wenger out a couple of years ago. Now I'll say, you know, that Emery has trashed his legacy. I think the problem is it isn't just this game. I mean, they've conceded more shots this season, Arsenal, than any other team in the Premier League, 96. Put that into context, City 31, Chelsea 48. So, you know, it's... And the other thing is, I mean, Peter McKeever from Opta points out they've also lost the ball closer to their own goal more than any other team in the Premier League.
I mean, you can barely lose it closer to your own goal than yesterday. The thing is, they were warned. With City, I think that might have been the first time that Norwich had really closed down a goal kick. But in the first half, it almost happened. And then surely you think...
I think it was the fifth time that they'd done that, that they got caught out.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I was laughed at in a few pods ago for suggesting they should, you know, try kicking it long, because at least if they're losing 50-50 balls in midfield, it's in midfield or it's in the opposition half, far away from goal. Whereas when you're losing what should be 90-10 balls on your own 18-yard box or inside it, they just keep repeating the same mistakes over and over and over again.
Somebody's going to come up with this revolutionary idea in football sometimes, which is you have a goalkeeper, say Dave Besant, who can hit the ball really long from a goal kick, and then you have a tall midfielder, say Vincent Jones, who knocks it down. And that is going to be a good tactic for somebody. This playing out from the back, the managers are suddenly going to get wise to this and just start launching it again.
To put that into context, the team that has lost the ball the least times close to their own goal, Burnley, only 7 times this season.
Dice ball.
Arsenal have lost the ball 34 times.
But I was watching, even when they played it long, Leno would give it to Louise, who would then pump it long. I guess the idea is creating an angle, or you're suggesting they're going to play it short, so they press, and then they have fewer people up there. It is obviously playing it out of the back can work, but you've got to be good, right? And you've got, it's decision making, right? And that, I just don't understand how you can go, that pass is the right pass, when there are two Watford players just sitting there.
Well, I think it's going to sound a bit dumb considering what happened to Otamendi at the weekend, but if we overlook that one, you know, it's like Pep Guardiola brought this innovation to the Premier League, carried it off, you know, like whoever decided that wearing tapered jeans that end halfway down your shin is trendy, and now I see every second man in Guardian Towers is trying to pull off the same look, but they're really not succeeding.
It's interesting because I obviously play rubbish amateur football, which no one's interested in, but opposition teams have started taking goal kicks like that.
Really?
It's unbelievable. Anya says, do you think David Luiz is a secret agent of Chelsea and is trying his hardest to make Chelsea finish above Arsenal? You were mentioning how slow Willem's step over was or you know, move to get past Trent Alexander-Arnold. Pereira didn't...
No.
He wasn't going at a rate of knots then for that penalty.
No, he hadn't burned him off Raheem Sterling style, had he? It was a telegraph. It was it almost wait till we get to the penalty box and then you can knock me over.
Very strange.
But Arsenal have conceded a penalty in each of the last 3 games. All of them were ridiculous. 2 of them were conceded by David Luiz. And in one of the games in which he conceded a penalty against Liverpool, he also made another bad error when he ran out of position and got skinned by Mo Salah, I think it was. I thought he'd be a really good signing for Arsenal, but he is costing them points, and in a defence which I suppose is already less than assured before his arrival, he just seems to be adding to the chaos. But you have to say, if they're conceding 31 shots against Watford, who are bottom of the league, where's the midfield?
Yeah.
Actually, that game ended, and it was like, both teams were playing 5-0-5. It was amazing.
I thought the last 20 minutes of that game was some of the most enjoyable football I've ever seen. Yeah. It was just crazy.
I was going to mention the midfield, and the name that always comes up is Granit Xhaka, who I have maligned and many people maligned. But he's the team captain at the moment. Now, he came out and gave that post-match interview in which he talks about players being scared. in the second half. Now, he's been given the captain's armband. He's someone that's talked about how he is a leader in life. Remember that quote when he joined the club, which was, "When I was a boy, my mum gave me the key to the door rather than my older brother."
Oh, yes.
That one. Mm. Now, I think what he attempted to do was, remember Roy Keane would come out after a Manchester United defeat and read the riot act to the rest of the players and talk about there's players here that aren't working hard enough. And several players have done it over the years, John Terry and Patrick Vieira. You name the great leaders of the Premier League era. Xhaka came out and did that. And unfortunately, he'd played like an absolute drain and may as well have been talking about himself looking scared and being unable to perform during the game. It was, at the paper here, that became the lead story because it's like, I can't believe that a player's come out and said that.
Pepe's got some criticism. Ollie says, will dribbling past Van Dijk being the best thing Nicholas, no goals in five games, Pepe does all season? Well, it's, I mean, he's young, but he's got a big price tag and that's what happens, right? It's you can't say he's responsible for Arsenal being so abject yesterday, can you?
Well, there are many reasons why they were abject. I suppose he has to take his share of the blame, but that's the thing about those big transfers, isn't it? Arsenal fans are all cock-a-hoop and delighted because, you know, oh, we got Nicolas Pepe. Getting the player is only half the battle. They then have to deliver. He's shown signs of promise. I think it's far too early to write him off. But, Arsenal fans seem in a state of terminal or permanent dissatisfaction. And they always seem to just waiting for things to get better. They're like hamsters on a wheel, really, just going nowhere.
This is from Neil. Has any manager ever worn the pain of football management on their face more expressively and hilariously than Unai Emery?
I've said this before. He always looks to me as though something near him smells bad. Like there's this look on his face of sort of trying to close his nose off so that he's only breathing through his mouth.
I would say Roy is the absolute best.
Yes,
isn't he? For just any sort of, he's so gif-able. I noticed he was talking to a chair. And after the Spurs game, clearly out of shot was whoever, Ray Lewington presumably, but it did look like he was just chatting to a chair. Producer Jonathan says Unai Emery looks like Rick Moranis playing Unai Emery. we should mention Watford. I thought Delafeo looked, I mean, it was hard to tell because Arsenal was so bad, but he looked sort of mesmerising. It was like there was nothing they could do against Delafeo. And every time he got the ball, he had 20 yards of space to run into. And their midfield was much better, wasn't it? Decore and Kapoue.
Well, they are a midfield, which helps these matters. Guendouzi is a player, a lot of whom is expected. He didn't have his best game. And he did one of those things, which is always creates a hostage to fortune, which is he left the field with Watford fans jeering and he made the 2-1 sign. There was about 25 minutes to go. Mm. Oh dear.
Yes, Watford tweeted out 2-2 with that picture below it. And actually, Delafeu had a chance. And Decore as well ran through late and hit one straight at Leno. He should have done.
But I don't think it's fair, actually, to say he hit it straight at Leno. I think Leno kind of guessed which way he was going to go.
Okay, I take it back. Wolves 2, Chelsea 5. All the headlines about Chelsea's three English youngsters all scoring. Should we start with Tammy Abraham? Considering after a couple of games people were writing him off, that's a very impressive hat-trick, isn't it, Sean?
It really is. He looked a little bit lost at sea against Man United. And I think there were quite a few critics that kind of suggested that his goals so far this season had come against sides that were essentially had come up from the Championship, and perhaps could he really do it against a really good side? And Wolves, I think, arguably have been one of the top defences, so to bang in a hat-trick was very, very impressive. And I quite like the cut of young Frank Lampard's ship. I mean, people talk about the youngsters, it's true, but the kind of way they're playing at the moment, it reminds me a bit of like Spurs 94, 95, where they're just kind of gung-ho, you know, you score 3, we'll try and score 4. I mean, I think they've conceded 2.2 goals this season, which isn't sustainable, but you know they're after what we saw last year with Chelsea, where they were grinding out lots of 1-0 wins. I've been really quite excited by them this year.
Yeah, I just thought the touch from Abraham to get past Connor Cody was beautiful, wasn't it? I mean, it made Connor Cody look a bit like a lamppost, but he's a good player, Cody. But that touch is just superb, isn't it?
Yes, I've seen the comparison made actually with Tammy Abraham and Harry Kane, which is a young player sent out on several loans, some of which he didn't really impress in. I mean, I saw Tammy Abraham play a couple of seasons ago for Swansea. It really wasn't happening for him. Yet when they come back to their parent club and they feel settled and they feel as though the manager's got faith in them, that's when they flourish. Now, it's an awful lot to ask him to meet Harry Kane's standards, but the signs are good.
Hmm. Do you think it's a matter of time before he gets in the England squad?
But there's talk, I think, in today's paper that he might declare for Nigeria.
Oh, really?
Think. So that's something I think is on the back of today's Times, yeah.
Huh.
I have no idea where his own particular affiliations lie, but would that perhaps be a come and get me plea to England before the next English international break?
I think that's from a Mick Zone quote where he said his mind isn't made up.
All right. Tomori's strike was glorious, wasn't it? It does look a bit like... Jorginho's shouting at him as he strikes the ball. I just wonder if Jorginho's saying, don't do that, whatever you do. A bit like everyone shouted at Vincent Kompany before he larruped that one in the top corner last season. Mason Mount, it's early days for a lot of us watching him. Can somebody explain what kind of midfielder he is? Because he looks great. I'm trying to make a sort of banal comparison with him that will weigh heavy around his neck for his whole career.
Is he Lampard-esque, perhaps?
No, I think he's
more Joe Cole of West Ham era.
Do you think? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's more...
He's more direct than Cole, and he's less tricky.
Cole was a very direct player when he was a West... Yeah, I suppose actually direct, that's true. Joe Cole was one of those, bit of a Peter Beagrie, would go back for another go at to beating him again, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Well,
maybe he's a totally new football that's never existed.
The thing is, they say, don't they, that English players now, because they watch so much football from around the world, aren't following the English-style model. So maybe he's more a Spanish-style player, like a David Silvery type or I was going to say Juan Mata. He's much quicker than Juan Mata, but
David Silva's enough to put pressure on Mason Mount.
That's next David Silva, there we go,
Mason. Good luck with that. Wolves have not been ahead in a league game yet this season. What's going on, Baz?
Is it maybe second season syndrome? It seems generally accepted that their Europa League exertions are affecting their league form, as is traditional with teams outside the top six who qualify for the Europa League. And yeah, it's kind of disappointing, really, because I had high-ish hopes for Wolves this season, and people have talked about them, Leicester, Everton, perhaps breaking into the top six, perhaps even breaking into the top four if a spot becomes available, and a couple of the teams in that top six look vulnerable. But they all lost over the weekend. Leicester lost, Everton lost, and Wolves got hockeyed. So it's kind of disappointing.
Chelsea start their Champions League campaign on Tuesday at home to Valencia. Also in that group, Ajax play Lille in what is one of the more interesting groups, in my opinion. Right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll begin at Old Trafford. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Hey, live shows, Barry. We're in Leeds on Friday. It's sold out, but we're looking forward to seeing you all. October the 30th, we're at the Science Museum.
Wow.
Yeah. Football Weekly versus Science is the title of the event.
I have a feeling I know who's going to win that particular contest. But, it could be an upset. We could do a Norwich.
We'll give it a good go. It's me and you plus two other podders. And we'll do a Football Weekly section, and then some scientists will come on and
make us look stupid.
Make us look stupid, yeah, if we haven't done that ourselves. Yeah. Also, some exciting news for those of you in the London and Dublin areas to be announced on Thursday. Right. Manchester United 1, Leicester 0, Marcus Rashford's early penalty. And John, given the fact that we all said, well, Leicester will probably win this game, and on paper they've got the better starting 11, and given who was missing for Manchester United, obviously Manchester United were going to win this game.
Yes. Good result for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. The crisis moves to Arsenal, say, or even Manchester City. Good week for him, perhaps until Europa League brings on another crisis or something like that. It's interesting that there is the message coming out of Old Trafford is this thing of rebuilding. I think the start of the season has been so underwhelming that it's accepted that this will be a season in which the cogs are put into place for the club's great comeback. I think Ollie's programme notes were to that end. But in a publication known as The Athletic, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, there's a good intro here. When Ole Gunnar Solskjaer first arrived at Manchester United, there was a large mosaic of the club crest hanging prominently at Carrington, which was not to his liking. In his view, the dozens of square tiles gave the badge a cracked appearance and thus presented a broken image in the place where players and staff spent most of their time.
So what's he done with it?
Well, he's had it redone. Okay. This is part of the rebuilding process.
Fixing some tiling.
Yeah. Attention to detail.
Okay.
And how's the grout are rich in victory?
Yeah. How is the grouting? Because that's the key, right?
Well, okay. I suppose what you say about this game, the winning goal was a penalty struck by Marcus Rashford without Paul Pogba breathing down his neck. Manchester United's best performer in the game, Scott McTominay, without Paul Pogba breathing down his neck. That's all I'm going to say.
So Pogba is not the grout?
No.
For you?
He's the anti-grout.
Paul Pogba's the anti-grout.
He's the mould.
Soyuncu gave away the penalty. He's got that in him, hasn't he? Or do I just think he's got that in him because he's got long hair? You know, in a duet, David Luiz...
Daniel Farker style.
Farker, Fellaini way. It makes players look less composed. Fair, unfair.
Well, look at Paolo Maldini. When you looked at him and his looks...
I always think he's got a ricket in Maldini. Got a touch of the Siunchus. That's what I thought. That's a very good point, Sean.
Yeah, was Maldini better when he had short hair or long hair?
I don't know. It's a bit like when I said I don't trust goalkeepers in short sleeves.
Well,
people shouted Iker Casillas at me for about 2 years.
I think Siunchu has played quite well this season. He didn't really get much of a look in last season. And... He's in there with Johnny Evans, and I think they've done pretty well. I would rather have them in the heart of my defence than John Stones and Nicolas Otamendi, put it that way.
Leicester's next game's home to Spurs, who beat Crystal Palace 4-0, 2 for Heung-min Son. They blew Palace away in the first 3 up after 23 minutes. Jacob Steinberg writing in the paper, look, when was the last time Tottenham produced a performance as complete as this in a league game? He's saying you'd have to go back to last season's Boxing Day demolition of Bournemouth to find one.
It looked very straightforward, though. They were just playing the ball through the centre and then out, diagonals out to the right, crosses coming in, boom, goal. And
well, actually, the first one was even simpler, wasn't it? Alderweireld just lumped it upfield, really, and Sacco just lost the ball.
It was a dreadful performance from Palace.
Although, if you look at the expected goals numbers, Spurs' chances weren't that good. But But, you know, obviously Son was brilliant. But the other thing that kind of piqued my interest was that when Spurs were 4-0 up on Match of the Day, the commentator said, well, at least those Palace fans haven't got that far to travel. So I Googled it, and White Hart Lane to Sellers Park. It's 90 minutes on a good day. And, of course, we've all been there, and we all know how long you have to queue. I reckon it's a two-hour trip on a Saturday when you're queuing everything else. That's a fairer way to travel.
Are you
I
saying it would be quicker for, say, a Norwich fan to get home? Oh, that's quite a long... not on driving, because you get stuck behind a tractor on the A141. But
there wouldn't be much difference in getting to Macclesfield than there would be to getting to Selhurst.
And that walk from White Hart Lane to Seven Sisters is a killer.
That is a killer, you're
right. It's because it's a totally straight line.
But I do agree that we should always presume that all the Crystal Palace fans basically live in Selhurst Park.
Yes.
As well. But I guess the point Jacob's making is this is a really vital win for Tottenham.
And also, there'd been this Poch rallying cry about let's pull together after the transfer window and the international break. Serge Aurier had an excellent game.
He did, didn't he?
At right back. Now, he's a player that wanted to leave in the transfer window. One of the things you would say about Poch is that while he's known as a player who, when he's had the use of someone, he is quite good at giving the cold shoulder, he's also good at bringing players back in. Think of Sissoko, who is a player that really you would have thought was on his way out of Tottenham at various points, turned him into a real player. And maybe Aurier can be that player, because I think Obviously, they lost Trippier. Kyle Walker-Peters perhaps isn't ready just yet. I mean, there's a player of experience that Tottenham need, and Poch is capable of turning those players into a proper part of the team.
Yeah, his delivery is really, really good, isn't it? Heung-min Son is obviously no longer underrated. He is rated. Can anyone see where would Son's next... You know, I would obviously love him to set Spurs forever, but he seems good enough to go into a City or a Barca or a Real. A
Bayern Munich or someone like that. I mean, he's actually Bayern Munich. He's played in Germany, played with great distinction there. Maybe he might be the type of player that they would look to. I mean, he's a brilliant player.
Isn't he? And two-footed as well, which is nice. Palace have scored just 3 goals so far this season. Spurs go to Olympiacos on Wednesday. Also in that group, Bayern host Red Star Belgrade. Bournemouth 3, Everton 1. Wes says, can we formally expel my team Everton from the Everton Cup now, please? Although at 1-1, Sean, I mean, Everton had a couple of chances, could have gone either way.
Yeah, it was one of those games, again, I don't want to sort of, if you look at the expected goals, it was pretty much the same. And I thought it was one of those games, as you say, it could have gone either way. I guess the question someone asks is, Everton spent 115 million this summer on a lot of players that kind of had potential but hadn't really fulfilled it. You know, the Alex Iwobis of this world. And
Alex Iwobis as well.
Yeah, still like the Alex Iwobis of this world. And you do have to ask, you know, are they going to make the step up? I guess on the flip side, you know, Everton have had a pretty good defence. This was, you know, they've had one of the better defensive records in the league for the last few months. So this was a bit of a blip. But again, I noticed a lot of the Everton fans were kind of the sort of the Marco Silva out train is starting to rumble out of the station, I think.
I think people presume that Bournemouth away will be just a nice, easy day.
I've seen some big teams get turned over there. And Bournemouth have a habit of starting quite poorly, which they have this season. Eddie Howe talked, didn't he, that they really needed to get a win. And, you know, he made a few changes and Ryan Fraser came on. Now, Ryan Fraser, he's in that so underrated, he's rated point at this point. He's an excellent little player. Mm-hmm. Actually, looking at him now, he has a very muscular build. But
doesn't he? I thought that when it cut him and he didn't celebrate. I thought maybe he's just too massive to run now.
Well, The game in which he made his breakthrough is another of those where a big team gets turned over, which was against Liverpool, where I think Bournemouth won 4-3. And after that game, Eddie Howe talked to the fact that Ryan Fraser had a rather Scottish diet, shall we say, and hadn't really looked after his physique. But once he turned that around, he would become a much better player. And I think that's been brought to bear. He's a player who's worked on his physique, is much fitter, and has the attributes of a Scottish ball player of the old style, but with the modern footballer as well.
How are you defining a Scottish diet, and how also would it compare to, say, to an Irish diet?
To a Glendening diet, or my own. Iron brew for breakfast, sweets at night.
Haggis for lunch and a normal meal in the evening. Is that
deep fried pizza, that type of thing.
I liked how you just managed to put it back by talking about great Scottish ball players of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
To say, you know, that you some of your best friends are Scottish.
Yes, in fact, one of them is. I'm going to his wedding next month.
Congratulations, Jock McSporran.
Jonathan Sterling is his name.
Yeah. Fair enough. Although Everton's defending for that Callum Wilson for the third goal. I mean, where are they? I mean, how is Callum Wilson? How is he clean through there? I couldn't work it out at all. Anyone?
And neither apparently could anyone else.
No one could work it out. But look, well done, Bournemouth.
Well, Callum Wilson's a very good player.
He is a good player.
And I think he's slightly underrated, actually, while we're on the subject. But although he is sort of a fringe England player, isn't he?
He's one of those players that picks up injuries at an untimely point where...
Yeah, and he picks up bad injuries.
Yeah.
But comes back from them with commendable... God, it must be so dispiriting. I think he's had 2 cruciates.
Yeah.
One of those must be absolutely heartbreaking, you know, just the tedium of rehab and then to have it happen again. I applaud anyone who can come back from those and... play with such distinction.
Sheffield United 0, Southampton 1. A lovely goal from Moussa Djenepo, second of the season. And it was a sort of, it was John Barnes at the Maracanã, in the sense that he didn't seem to dribble past anyone, just ran on a straight line and everyone got out the way. Is that fair?
And he also did this sort of hold off of a defender that was grappling on him. Sort of,
oh, it was an excellent advantage from the ref, yeah, wasn't it?
Great strength, I would put that as well.
We should point out that John is doing a little kind of hand thingy with his, our listeners can't see, but it's actually really quite kind of like he's dancing to some like 70s...
Pardew FA Cup final goal celebration.
I like Chris Wilder and I like the way he talks after a game. He's like, yeah, that Billy Sharp red was a was fair enough and we didn't, you know, we shouldn't concede that goal. He's very honest. He said that Sheffield United should have had a penalty when the ball hit James Ward-Prowse's hand. I mean, I just don't know anymore.
Well, my understanding is that it shouldn't be a penalty by the rules because James Ward-Prowse was defending at the time. If it had hit a attacking player's arm, it would have been a foul. Obviously not a penalty, but that's them's the rules now, and they're ridiculous. Like, absolutely ridiculous.
I guess the other thing to point out is that Ireland's David McGoldrick had three, I think, decent chances. And I think he was the club's player of the year last year, but only scored 15 and 44. And again, a lot of Sheffield United fans have been critical of him. I don't know what Baz thinks. I mean, he obviously scored last week for Ireland against Switzerland. But do you think he's just hasn't quite got that quality needed?
I haven't seen enough of him to know. I think it's a classic case of he needs one to go in off his arse or whatever. But I think any Sheffield United fans who are complaining about their lot already should really need to wind their necks in.
at B. Glenn Denning, if you want to say something nice to Barry. Finally, Brighton 1, Burnley 1. Both teams won their first game of the season. Burnley beating Southampton, Brighton beating Watford. Both those wins seem quite a long time ago now.
Yeah, the Graham Potter sheen of total football has slightly gone, though. During this game, he made a couple of switches which improved Brighton's play during the game. But the best piece of total football was Jeff Hendrick's goal, which was a magnificent sweeping move from one end to the other with a great finish. Fantastic goal.
Tonight, Aston Villa play West Ham. A win for West Ham would see them go level on points with Manchester City. They'd need to win by 11 goals to go above them. But still, West Ham have had a good start, haven't they? It'll be a nice claret and blue affair. The Football League, the top two in the Championship going into the weekend were both beaten 1-0. Swansea at home by Nottingham Forest. Charlton were beaten by Birmingham. 16-year-old Jude Bellingham scoring the winner for the second game running. Leeds are now top with a 2-0 win in a Yorkshire derby over Barnsley. Bristol City moved to fourth by winning 2-1 at Bottomside Stoke, who are just on a wretched run under Nathan Jones. They had Joe Allen sent off after 12 minutes for a nasty lunge with Stoke 1 up at the time. Danny Cowley's first game in charge of Huddersfield ended in defeat as they got beaten 2-0 by Gary Monk's Sheffield Wednesday. Only one team in the bottom half won. That was Middlesbrough, who lifted themselves to 13th with a 1-0 win over Reading. A derby really struggling as well under Philip Cocu. Only one win for them so far this season. In League One, three of the top four drew. The other, Wickham, lost at Gillingham. Two teams scored six. Peterborough very lucky to sneak past Rochdale 6-0. Rotherham beat bottomside Bolton 6-1. They're still on minus 11 with a goal difference of minus 22. In League 2, Exeter stays top despite being held 2-2 by Leighton Orient. Swindon and Forest Green both won their second and third. Cambridge heroically won 3-2 at 10-man crew with incredibly dodgy penalty. There is a full League 1 and League 2 programme on Tuesday. In women's football, Spurs beat Liverpool 1-0 to pick up their first ever WSL win with a penalty. Everton and City are first and second, both with two wins out of two, both with 2-0 wins this weekend. West Ham beat Birmingham 1-0. Brighton and Chelsea shared a 1-1 draw, both goals coming in the last 10 minutes. Manchester United and Arsenal meet tonight for the first time in the league. Arsenal won 2-1 in this fixture in the semi-finals of the WSL Cup last season. Baz, you watched the highlights show on the BBC. What did you make of it?
It was a curate's egg of a show, I suppose. Good in spots. Reshman Chowdhury, friend of the show, was presenting it from Adams Park. She had guests on, giving their opinions. It was the coverage of the actual football. You know, that was all good and interesting for me as someone who doesn't know a huge amount about sport but would like to know more. But the coverage of the actual game, highlights of games were ridiculously short. It's only half hour long. It's buried on BBC4 without much advertising. I just happened to get wind it was on because I saw they mentioned it on Match of the Day. And most of the grounds, as far as I can tell, they just had sort of one camera on top of a stand following all the action. So I just thought, considering the big licks they gave the Women's World Cup during the summer, they'd have made more of an effort to give the Women's Super League more coverage. I suppose you could level the same accusation at us, but we have a far more limited window of opportunity than the BBC, you know, twice a week. And I don't expect them to put it on prime time on a Sunday evening, but, you know, at least flag it up, give people who might be interested more notice of where they can find it, and send a couple of cameras to the ground. You know, it just seemed a bit of a token effort.
It's a bit like...
And I do appreciate that there are a lot of people out there who roll their eyes to heaven and have no interest in women's football. That's fine, but it is quite obvious there is a market there to be tapped. You know, everyone was raving about the huge attendances they got at games last week. I don't think there were anywhere near any 25,000 attendances this time round, but there is a market for it there, clearly.
In Europe, Arsenal won 4-0 at Fiorentina in the last 32 as they returned to Champions League football for the first time since 2014. And Man City beat Lugano 7-1 in their first leg. Barry, back to you and Fitbar Corner.
Routine wins for Celtic and Rangers. I think Celtic beat Hamilton 1-0 away. Rangers beat Livingston 3-1. I suppose the most interesting thing is trouble in Edinburgh, where both the Hearts manager Craig Levein and the Hibernian manager Paul Heckingbottom are both under pressure already this season. Hearts are bottom of the table, and they lost 3-2 at home to Motherwell, and there was a protest afterwards, a section of fans looking for Levein to leave. He's manager, he's director of football, he's on the board, he's Mr. Hearts, and he doesn't want to go. And as we've seen from his time as Scotland manager, when Craig Levein doesn't want to leave a job, it's kind of hard to get rid of him. It's quite early in the season, but they've only won 2 of their past 18 top-flight games. Don't think they've won a game this season yet. No, they haven't won a game this season yet. They only have 2 points. And then across the city at Hibs, Heckingbottom's Hibernian are slightly better positioned. I think they're 3 or 4 places above. They're fourth from bottom, and the two teams meet next week, so maybe one of the managers will get a little bit of wriggle room if they can win that Edinburgh derby.
In Championship manager generated football names, one of the scorers for Motherwell against Hearts was Sherwin Seedorf, who according to Wikipedia is a distant relative of Clarence. Also in Scotland, Hibs women lost 4-1 at home to Slavia Prague in the Champions League. Glasgow City grabbed a 1-0 win at Chertanovo of Moscow. And that'll do for part two. Part three will begin in Spain with Sid Lowe. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's begin in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you doing?
Not too bad, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm marvellous, thanks very much. So Barcelona beat Valencia, and then you manage a 5-2. The first two Barca goals scored and then set up by a 16-year-old. Talk to us about Ansu Fati.
Well, this is the point at which we try not to get excited, but then can't help it. And this has been kind of the response to him, because the performance in the first half from him was absolutely mind-blowing. As you say, he scores the first 111 seconds into his first ever start at the Camp Nou. He then provides the second with a brilliant piece of skill 5 minutes later. The third time he gets the ball, he nutmegs someone on the edge of the area and bends a shot that misses the top corner by a fraction. And even Valverde after the game, he said, look, it's not normal. It's not normal for his first touch to be a goal, his second touch to be an assist, his third touch to almost be a top corner. Then he got brought down in the penalty area. Referee kind of winked at him and said, you know, stop diving. But actually, watch it again. I think, that might be a penalty. No one's really talked about it. He then does this extraordinary bit of skill where he flips the ball over Daniel Vaz's head. But it wasn't that. It was just that. It was the fact that every time he got the ball, he looked dangerous, but he also chose his moments well. the performance was just brilliant. And of course, it's not a one-off in so far as he came on as a sub away at Osasuna and scored within 5 minutes. In his first game as a Barcelona player, where he became the second youngest player ever to make a debut for them, this is now 3 weeks ago because of the international break, he came on and was prepared to go at people, didn't look at all overawed by it. And yeah, he's 16, and he's one of those 16-year-olds who kind of looks like it as well.
Yeah.
So you sort of, you can't help but kind of, it's one of those where you sort of watch him play and you can't help but sort of start laughing, basically.
Yeah. Where does he play? Who's he playing instead of?
Well, this is, I mean, obviously this is part of the debate now, is what happens next. And of course, you know, everybody knows that he's playing because Suarez has been injured, because Messi's been injured, because Dembele is injured, because Neymar hasn't turned up. He's been playing wide on the left-hand side. Victor Valdes, who's the coach who had him, but not for very long, in the under-19s team, was saying, you know, this is someone you've got to give freedom to in the penalty area. He'll score loads of goals. It looks like that's a quite a good fit for him wide, because he was prepared to stay wide when they needed to open the pitch up, but happy to come inside when the attacker allowed for that. And of course, as I say, that, you know, the first goal is a finish right-footed deep inside the penalty area. He looks really, really good. Everyone's trying very hard to say, you know, let's calm down, let's take it easy, let's not get overexcited. But everyone is very, very excited. I mean, probably the best example of that is the front page. I'm just going to turn it over now of El Mundo Deportivo. No, but El Mundo Deportivo's front page is a pathetically poor pun. The front page of Sport it is, and it just says, "What planet did you come from?" Now, for those who don't know, in English, that's basically the final part of the famous commentary of Diego Maradona's goal against England in 86. So, you know, this is not just saying this guy's out of this world. It's also saying we're explicitly linking this to Maradona now.
I always thought the commentary was, what the hell is Terry Fenwick doing? But slightly different. Valencia came into this match with a brand new manager. How's that news going down?
Not at all well. I mean, it's genuinely shambolic what's happened. They sacked Marcelino in midweek. They sacked him for reasons that were nothing to do with football. And I think this is expressed in the way that Albert Celades, the coach who came in, has been talking. He's been talking like a man at a funeral. Not a man who's just been given the opportunity to coach Valencia, partly because, of course, he's aware that that's the mindset of everyone around him. But this, while we knew it was coming, because the breakdown, the relationship between Marcelino and the club has been there for a while and was very, very public throughout the summer. When it happened, players weren't happy, fans are not happy, everybody's furious. And to give you an example, I think it's Garay put on Instagram a message that basically said, you know, thanks to the manager, thanks for everything you did for us, you're a great person. And he said, the people who took this decision don't just drag you down, they drag everyone down. And I think the phrase might even be, they've trampled all over us. So this, you know, and Valencia decided that no one from the club was going to talk at the weekend apart from the manager. None of the players were going to talk. And of course, the reason for that is the players were likely to come out and say, this is a load of old bollocks. We shouldn't be doing this.
Eden Hazard made his debut for Real Madrid. 3-2 win over Levante, but they were sort of clinging on at the end, weren't they?
Yeah, and they shouldn't have been, because they actually played very well in the first half. They were 3-0 up. They should have been home and dry. They conceded one earlier in the second half, then got another one. Levante got another one late on to make it 3-2. And at that point, Madrid did fall apart a bit. Ramos went off, and in particular Casemiro went off, and that midfield was kind of a bit of a joke in truth. And Zidane afterwards was asked about it. First time I think I've heard him be quite as direct as this. He said, well, I look at the bench and there wasn't a lot else I could do in terms of players for these positions. Toni Kroos playing deep midfield, Lucas Vazquez playing alongside him in midfield. It's not really the midfield you want, but you know, there were good things from Madrid, but the last 15 minutes were pretty dreadful. And Hazard came on and did one of those classic Hazard runs, you know, picking it up wide on the left-hand side, going all the way across the pitch, bending the shot in by the far post. The goalie made a really good save, but there's quite a lot of excitement about him. He still looks a tiny bit heavy, because of course he hasn't played yet this season because of injury, but I think he's going to be really quite good.
And Atletico lost 2-0 at Real Sociedad. Martin Odegaard and Nacho Monreal scoring the goals, so the last team to give up their 100% record. What happened there?
Well, what happened there in truth was that they were totally outplayed. Real Sociedad playing the first game in, well, not the new stadium, it's the old stadium that's been redeveloped. And so they finally got rid of the running track, which was awful, put stands right close to the goals at both ends. Really loads of noise, a really good performance from a team that's really nice in possession, a really good football team. They got bullied a little bit by Athletic the last game before the break, but they were really, really good. And they've been good actually most of the season. And Martin Ødegaard looks fantastic. Oyarzabal, we already knew, was a really good player. And they were much, much the better side against Atletico Madrid. And, you know, you see it in the number of shots taken, in the possession, in everything. My favourite stat, though, is the stat about the stadium. And I love this, and I think this sums up how much better it is. 32 metres That's how much closer the fans behind the goal are to the pitch than they were before.
Ah, change everything, won't it? There, look, the four best looking Champions League games, I reckon, are all the games with Spanish sides in it. You know, we've mentioned Valencia going to Chelsea, Atletico Juve, Real Madrid, PSG, Dortmund, Barca. Which are you most excited by?
I suppose Atletico Juve, because I'm selfish and it's one I'm going to. I must admit, I find it a little bit hard to be overexcited about Paris Saint-Germain, not least because I feel like them and Madrid will both get through the group and because they're without Mbappe and without Neymar, although Kaylin Navas will play. And I suppose Barcelona away at Dortmund, because you know they've had two home games in the league. They won them both 5-2, but they haven't won away. Luis Suarez, I think it's today, is the anniversary of when he last scored away in the Champions League. That's 4 years ago now. And, you know, Messi was very clear about this in that interview in midweek, that he said, you know, we've got to start scoring goals away from home or we're not going to go anywhere in the Champions League. So this feels like a proper test for them going away. And also they're up against Paco Alcácer, who, of course, was a former Barcelona player who's scoring absolutely loads of goals at the moment.
And listen, Sid, listeners, very excited about the fact that almost for the first time ever, we can hear pretty much everything you're saying.
Well, I hope so. Our exceptionally clever kind of shortcut to doing this is, it worked last time, but let's not get cocky just yet.
Yeah, we mustn't count our chickens. Cheers, Sid.
Cheers.
Take it easy. Sid Lowe out in Spain. To Germany, the big game saw RB Leipzig and Bayern Munich draw 1-1 in Leipzig. Bayern went ahead through Robert Lewandowski in the third minute, his seventh goal in four games, before Emil Forsberg levelled just before half-time. Leipzig stay top, with Bayern 2 points behind in fourth. Borussia Dortmund moved up to second by beating last season's fourth-place team Bayer Leverkusen 4-0. Jadon Sancho got an assist for one of Marco Reus's two goals, and Paco Alcácer got the opener, keeping up a hot scoring streak. He scored in every competitive game he's played in so far this season, 10-8 for club and country in four different competitions. Hertha Berlin are bottom. They thought they'd won their second point of the season when they made it 1-1 against Mainz in the 83rd minute, but Mainz found a winner 5 minutes later. The goalscorer has a good name, Jeremiah St. Juiced. From Germany to Italy now, Nicky Bandini's roundup with another 4-3 scoreline, this time not involving Napoli.
Yes, there was an astonishing game played in Brescia on Sunday. Brescia were 2-0 up inside 20 minutes against Bologna. They were 3-1 up at half-time, but they wound up on the wrong side of a 7-goal thriller. Complicit in their own collapse, I would say. Daniele De Senna picked up a second yellow for diving and trying to win a penalty at the start of the second half. But Bologna were also much improved by a pair of substitutions, as well as a half-time roasting from Sinisa Mihajlovic, with the twist here being that Mihajlovic was more than 100 miles away in the Sant'Orsola Hospital, where he's been receiving treatment for leukemia. He delivered his instructions as well as his pep talk via phone to his assistant, Emilio De Leo, who then passed them on to the players. And on Sunday evening, the team bus took a detour back so they could visit him in hospital as well, where, of course, he got a bit choked up, but also warned them to come back on Wednesday so that he could watch the game with them all in his room and tell them everything they did wrong. So Mihajlovic still making this remarkable start to the season with Bologna despite his illness. They've got 7 points from three games, which is their best start since 2002, and is enough to put them level on points for now with Juventus, who drew away to Fiorentina. Not an encouraging performance for Juve at all as they head into a tricky Champions League tie with Atletico Madrid. The lack of energy in the side really encapsulated in the second half moment when Frank Ribery, of all people, ran down and tackled Cristiano Ronaldo after giving him a 5-yard head start. Inter won later on Saturday, making this the first time since March 2018, more than 550 days ago, that Juventus have not been at least joint first in the Serie A table. So big moment there as well. Perhaps, of course, still very, very early, but it's been a long time since someone else has had the lead in Italy. Torino could also join Inter for now at the top if they win on Monday night. There is another note on the Inter game, unfortunately, which is an incident of just horribly casual racism on a local TV station in Italy, Tele Lombardia, where a pundit, Luciano Passirani, was praising Lukaku, saying all the reasons he's hard to stop, and then threw out the suggestion that the only way you could stop him was to feed him 10 bananas. The station reacted swiftly, condemning what Passirani had said and stating he won't be booked again, but it's just hugely dispiriting that something like this can happen again so casually after all that has already happened this season, and also in the context of a weekend when Frank Kessier was also subjected to monkey chants during Milan's win away to Verona. Verona, by the way, who responded to that on Monday with a pair of tweets from their official account suggesting that observers must simply have been dazed by the enthusiasm of their support, and that all they themselves had heard were inevitable whistles against refereeing decisions. So there's that. Napoli and Atalanta did also both win ahead of their Champions League ties. I know I'm running long with this segment, Max, but I do want to squeeze in a quick mention for Atalanta's Duvan Zapata as well. He was up against his cousin Christian, who plays in defence for Genoa, and very much won that little family head-to-head. He won a penalty from Christian in the first half and scored a thunderous 95th minute winner. Well worth going and checking that one out, and gave his cousin a good bamboozle in a one-on-one in between.
Thank you so much, Nicky. In France, Neymar made his comeback as PSG beat Strasbourg. He was booed by his own fans, then scored the only goal of the game with a bicycle kick in the 92nd minute as the champions go top. They took their time, though, didn't they? Monaco are still in the bottom two. They went from 2-0 up to a 4-3 defeat to Marseille, who move up to fourth. Second place, Rennes, were held to a goalless draw at Brest, while Nantes in third won 1-0 over Reims. Some final questions, everybody. From friend of the pod, Salon Andy Hickman says, what did Barry think of Dulwich Hamlet throwing away a 2-0 lead at home?
I wasn't particularly bothered. I had a nice day out at Champion Hill. Bumped into Salon, who blanked me last time I'd seen her and met her on Brixton High Street, and she just completely ignored me. She apologised for that and said I should come along to watch her play. I think it was she must play for Dulwich Hamlet Women, and they apparently play on Sundays, so I might make that my next visit.
Who did they lose to?
They lost to Hungerford Town, who were bottom of the table, threw away a two-goal lead, a half-time lead, lost 3-2. Although such are the myriad distractions at Champion Hill that I've discovered it is possible to realise the team you're nominally supporting can concede two goals without you even noticing.
What are the myriad other things you can do?
A bar.
Up to Fred says, watching Sunday League this weekend with the blistering heat, my dad wondered aloud why referees don't wear caps like goalkeepers if it's hot and sunny. Are there apparel laws for refs that prohibit them from wearing caps? I don't know, but I'd like it. I wouldn't mind referees being forced to wear hats of our choice before a football match. I'd like the idea of Martin Atkinson strolling out and just before the game someone hands him a fedora or a top hat. A sombrero for Paul Tierney. Producer Jonathan says they'd fall off. Goalkeepers don't run around. Yeah, but sometimes marathon runners wear those caps.
Yeah,
and
do,
cyclists
yeah.
wear... Do they wear caps or they wear helmets? So it's, I guess
they have to wear helmets these days.
They do. They used to wear caps back in the Indurain days, didn't they?
Yeah.
There you go.
But some of them still wear caps under their helmets.
Wow. Well, maybe referees should wear caps and helmets.
Yes.
I mean, that would be a... That could be a hat of choice.
Well, they could wear Biggles-style flying, leather flying goggles, which strap under the chin.
I reckon Mike Dean, being the banter merchant that he is, he'd go Peaky Blinders, wouldn't he?
Do you think?
Yeah.
Or what about full Stormtrooper?
What are you suggesting about it?
I'm just saying, what about, you know, Mike Dean could put on a Stormtrooper's hat and run around.
Isn't that a mask rather than a hat?
I mean, it's got a bit of both in it, hasn't it?
Well, it's more of a mask.
I've gone helmet.
It's helmet. Yeah, it's helmet.
I think he prefers to see have his face seen, doesn't he?
You're right.
Facial expressions.
You're absolutely right. It's not a mask like Zorro mask, is it?
I always get confused with the Star Wars things. What are they called?
Stormtroopers.
Oh, they are the Stormtroopers.
Yeah.
That's a mask.
No, but it's got a full hat on the back as well, Sean. Go and do your chief sports reporting. Find this out. Uncover what it officially is.
My first experience of Star Wars, my dad took me to the double show in Luton ABC, so I got to see Star Wars and then The Empire Strikes Back.
Wow.
But then the next time he took me to the cinema, he tried to smuggle me into Conan the Barbarian, which I think was an 18, and I was about 7 at the time, and we were restricted.
One of my best friends, Nick, watched Star Wars and loved it so much that then he would consistently open the Radio Times and find Alec Guinness films and then get continually disappointed that they weren't very Star Wars-like. Hey, thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, John.
Cheers.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.